Chapter 1, Part 2. As a human being, I am here, an ordinary human being. I have not read a thing. I want to know. Where am I to begin? I have to work, in a garden, as a cook, in a factory, an office. I have to work. And also there are the wife and children. I love them. I hate them. I am a sexual addict because that is the only escape offered to me in life. Here I am. That is my map of life, and I start from here. I cannot start from over there. I start here, and I ask myself what it is all about. I know nothing about God. You can invent, pretend. I have a horror of pretending. If I do not know, I do not know. I am not going to quote Shankara, Buddha, or anybody. So I say, this is where I start. Can I bring about order in my life? Order not invented by me or by them, but order that is virtue. Can I bring it about? And to be virtuous, there must be no battle, no conflict in me or outside. Therefore, there must be no aggressiveness, no violence, no hate, no animosity. And I find out I am afraid. I must be free of fear. To be conscious of it is to be aware of all this, aware of where I am. And then I find out I can be alone, not carry all the burdens of memory. I can be alone because I have understood order in my life, and I have understood order because I have denied disorder, because I have learned about disorder. Disorder means conflict, acceptance of authority, complying, imitation, all that. That is disorder. The social morality is disorder. Out of that I will bring order in myself, not myself as a petty little human being in a backyard, but as a human being. Every human being is going through this hell. So if I, as a human being, understand this, I have discovered something that all human beings can discover. Krishnamurti. So what is the self? The whole process of identification. My house, my name, my possessions, what I will be, the success, the power, the position, the prestige, the identification process is the essence of the self. Can this identification come to an end if thought doesn't identify itself with possessions? Because identification gives it pleasure, position, security. The root of the self is the movement of thought. When thought comes to an end, that is a form of death while living. Now, can thought come to an end? Every human being has identified himself and so conditioned himself with something or other. While living, can that death, which is the end of thought, take place? Walpola Rahula. I agree when you say it is not necessary to wait until the end of your life. Buddha pointed out the same thing when this question was put to him. When asked what would happen to the Buddha after his death, he asked the disciple, "What is Buddha? Is it this body?" Just as you asked about the name, the form, exactly what you said. In Buddhist terminology, this is called Kamarupa. K. Sir, if I may ask, I hope you don't think me impudent. Why do we bring in the Buddha? We are talking as human beings. W.R. Just because I raise the question from the Buddha's point of view. K. Ah, no, as a human being I want to know. Can one live in daily life without the self? W.R. Of course, my question was not that. The question is, what happens to the person who has realized the truth, who has become liberated, free? K. I would never ask that question. Because he might say this happens, or he might say that happens, or nothing happens. Then it becomes a theory to me, which is an idea. W.R. I wanted from you a little more than that. K. Ah, you want from me. W.R. Not a theory. K. If you want it from this person who is talking, you have to inquire as he is inquiring, and therefore he asks, is it possible to live in daily life, not at the end of one's existence, in daily life, without this identification process, which brings about the structure and the nature of the self, which is the result of thought? Can the movement of thought end while I am living? That is the question, rather than what happens when I die. The me is merely a movement of thought. Thought itself is very limited. So, can a human being, you or I, or any of us, can we live without the movement of thought, which is the essence of the self? Suppose the speaker, this person, says, yes, it is possible. I know it is possible. Then what? What value has it to you? Either you accept it, or you say, don't be silly, and walk away, and it is not possible, and you leave it. But if you want to inquire and say, look, is it possible? Let's find out, not as an idea, but as an actuality in daily life. G. Narayan. Dr. R., we have been talking in this context of the value of Buddhist meditation, preparation, practice, mindfulness. What is the value of all those things that are mentioned in the Buddhist literature, which is practiced as a very important thing in relation to the ending of thought? K. Sir, I hope you don't think me impudent or irreverent to what the Buddha said. I personally haven't read all these things. I don't want to read a thing about all this. They may be correct or not correct. They may be under illusion or not under illusion. They may have been put together by disciples. And what the disciples do with their gurus is appalling, twist everything. So I say, look, I don't want to start with somebody telling me what to do or what to think. I have no authority. I say, look, as a human being, suffering, going through agonies, sex, and mischief, and terror, and all the rest of it, in inquiring into all that, I come to the point which is thought. That's all. I don't have to know all the literature in the world, which will only condition further thinking. So forgive me for putting it that way. I brush all that aside. We have done this, Christians, I have met Christians, Benedictine monks, Jesuits, great scholars, always quoting, 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 believing this is so, this is not so. You understand, sir? I hope you don't think I am irreverent. You see, I only start with what is a fact for me. What is a fact, not according to some philosophers and religious teachers and priests, a fact. I suffer, I have fear, I have sexual demands. How am I to deal with all these tremendously complex things which make my life? And I am so utterly miserable, unhappy. From there I start, not from what somebody said, that means nothing. I am not belittling, forgive me, the Buddha, I wouldn't. W.R. That I know. I know you have the highest respect for the Buddha, but we have the same attitude, and I want to examine it with you. That is why I put the question. K. No, sir, not quite, sir. Forgive me for saying so, not quite. I start with something which is common to all of us, not according to the Buddha, not according to some Christian god or Hindu or some group. To me, all that is totally irrelevant. They have no place because I suffer. I want to find out to end it. I see the root of all this confusion, uncertainty, insecurity, travail, effort. The root of this is the self, the me. Now, is it possible to be free of the me, which produces all this chaos, both outwardly, politically, religiously, economically, and all the rest of it, and also inwardly, this constant struggle, constant battle, constant effort? I am asking, can thought end? So thought has no future. That which ends then has a totally different beginning, not the beginning of the me, ending and picking up again later. Can this thought end? The priest comes along and says, yes, it can end. Only identify yourself with Christ, with the Buddha. You follow? Identify, forget yourself. Some people have said, suppress it. Identify the self with the highest, which is still the movement of thought. Some people have said, burn out all the senses. They have done it, fasting. Do everything for this thing. Somebody like me comes along and says, effort is the very essence of the self. Do we understand that? Or has it become an idea, and we carry that idea out? A person like me says, effort of any kind only strengthens the self. Now, how do you receive that statement? When you eat, you are eating because you are hungry. The stomach receives the food. There is no idea of receiving the food. So, can you listen? Listen without the idea of receiving or accepting or denying or arguing. Just listen to a statement. It may be false, it may be true, but just listen to it. Can you do it? After carefully explaining the mood of thought, which identifies itself with the form, with the name, with this and that and the other thing, after explaining very carefully, it is said that thought is the very root of the self. Now, how do we receive, listen to the truth of that fact, that thought is the root of the self? Is it an idea, a conclusion, or is it an absolute, irrevocable fact? W.R., if you ask me, it is a fact. You see, I listen to it, receive it, I see it. K., are you listening as a Buddhist? Forgive me for putting it that way. W.R., I don't know. K., no, you must know. W.R., I am not identifying anything at all. I am not listening to you as a Buddhist or a non-Buddhist. K. I am asking you, sir, are you listening as a Buddhist? Are you listening as a person who has read a great deal about the Buddha and about what the Buddha has said, and therefore you are comparing, and therefore you have gone away from listening? So, are you listening? I am not being personal, sir, forgive me. W.R. Oh, you can be quite free with me. I won't misunderstand you, and you won't misunderstand me. K. No, no. I don't mind you misunderstanding me at all. I can correct it. Are you listening to the idea, to the words, and the implication of those words, or are you listening without any sense of verbal comprehension, which you have gone through quickly, and you say, yes, I see the absolute truth of that? W.R. That is what I said. K. Do you? W.R. Yes. K. No, sir. Then it is finished. It is like seeing something tremendously dangerous. It is over. You don't touch it. I wonder if you see it. When you say something to me about what the Buddha has said, I listen. I say, he is just quoting from what Buddha has said. But he is not saying something I want to know. He is telling me about the Buddha. But I want to know what you think, not what Buddha thought. Because then we are establishing a relationship between you and me, and not between you, Buddha, and me. I wonder if you see that. David Bohm. It seems to me this question of identification is the main one. It is very subtle. In spite of all that you have said, identification still goes on. K. Of course. DB. It seems to be built into us. Questioner. And this raises a question whether that identification can be ended, if I understood rightly. DB. Identification prevented listening freely, openly, because one listens through the identification. K. What does identification mean? Why do human beings identify themselves with something? My car, my house, my wife, my children, my country, my God, my... You follow? Why? Q. To be something, perhaps. K. Let's inquire why. I identify not only with outward things, but also inwardly with my experience. I identify with experience and say, this is my experience. Why do human beings go through this all the time? DB. At one stage, you said we identify with our sensations. For example, our senses. And this seems very powerful. What would it be not to identify with our sensations? K. When I listen, am I listening to identify myself with the fact? Or is there no identification at all, and therefore listening with a totally different ear? Am I hearing with the ears of my hearing, or am I hearing with total attention? Am I listening with total attention, or is my mind wandering off and saying, oh my goodness, this is rather boring? Can I attend so completely that there is only the act of listening and nothing else, no identification, no saying, yes, that is a good idea, bad idea, that's true, that's false, which are all processes of identification. But without any of those movements, can I listen? When I do so listen, then what? The truth that thought is the essence of the self, and the self creates all this misery, is finished. I don't have to meditate. I don't have to practice. It is over when I see the danger of these things. Can we listen so completely that there is the absence of the self? And one says, can I see, observe something without the self, which is my country, I love that sky, it is a beautiful sky, and all the rest of that. The ending of thought, which is the ending or cutting at the very, very root of the self, a bad simile, but take that. When there is such active, attentive, non-identifying attention, then does the self exist? I need a suit. Why should there be identification in getting a suit? I get it. There is getting it. So the active listening implies listening to the senses, to my taste, the whole sensory movement. I mean, you can't stop the senses, then you would be paralyzed. But the moment I say, that's a marvelous taste, I must have more of that, begins the whole identification. DB. It seems to me that that is the general condition of mankind, to be identifying with the senses. Now, how are we going to change that? K. That is the whole problem, sir. Mankind had been educated, conditioned for millennia, to identify with everything. My guru, my house, my God, my country, my king, my queen, and all the horror that goes on. DB. You see, with each one of those, there is a sensation. K. It is a sensation, which you call experience. When there is the ending of the self, what takes place? Not at the end of my life, not when the brain becomes deteriorated, when the brain is very, very active, quiet, alive, when that takes place, when the self is not? Now, how can you find out, sir? Say X has ended the self completely, not picks it up in the future, another day, but ends it completely. He says, yes, there is a totally different activity which is not the self. What good is that to me, or to any of us? He says, yes, it can end. It is a different world altogether, different dimension. not a sensory dimension, not an intellectual projected dimension, something totally different. I say he must either be a cuckoo, a charlatan, or a hypocrite. But I want to find out, not because he says so, but I want to find out. Can I, as a human being, living in this tremendously ugly, brutal, violent world, economically, socially, morally, and all the rest of it, live without the self? I want to find out. And I want to find out not as an idea. I want to do it. It's my passion. Then I begin to inquire, why is there identification with the form, with the name? It is not very important whether you are K or W or Y. So you examine this very, very carefully, not to identify yourself with anything, with sensation, with ideas, with a country, with an experience. You understand, sir? Can you do it? Not vaguely and occasionally, but with passion, with intensity, to find out. Then what place has thought? You understand, sir? What place has thought? Has it any place at all? Obviously, when I am talking, I am using words. The words are associated with memory, and so on, and so on. So there is thinking there, not with me. There is very little thinking as I am talking. Don't let's go into that. So thought has a place. When I have to catch a train, when I have to go to the dentist, when I go to do something, thought has its place. But it has no place psychologically, as when there is the identifying process taking place, right? I wonder if you see. DB, you are saying it is identification that makes thought do all the wrong things. K, that's right. Identification has made thought do the wrong things. DB, it would be all right otherwise. K, otherwise, thought has its place. DB, but when you say no identification, you mean the self is empty, that it has no content, doesn't it? K, there are only sensations. DB, sensations, but they are not identified. They are just going on, do you mean? K, yes, sensations are going on. DB, outside or inside? K, inside. GN, and you are also implying there is no slipping back. K, of course not. When you see something most dangerous, you don't slip back or go forward. It is dangerous. Sir, then is that death? That is the question we began with. Is there a living with the sensations fully awakened? They are awakened, they are alive, but the non-identifying with sensation deprives, wipes away the self. We said that. Is it possible to live a daily life with death, which is the ending of the self? The moment you have an insight, it is finished. DB, would you say the insight transforms the person? K, the insight transforms not only the state of the mind, but the brain cells themselves undergo a change. DB, therefore, the brain cells, being in a different state, behave differently. It is not necessary to repeat the insight. K, either it is so or it is not so. I am left with this now. I am left with the question of what is death? Is the ending of the self death? Death in the ordinary accepted sense of the word? Is it not, obviously, because the blood is circulating, the brain is working, the heart is pumping, and all the rest of it? DB, it is still alive. K, it is alive, but the self is non-existent, because there is no identification of any kind. This is a tremendous thing. Non-identification with anything, with experience, with belief, with a country, with ideas, with ideals, wife, husband, love, no identification at all. Is that death? People who call that death say, My God, if I don't identify myself with my something or other, why, I am nothing. So they are afraid of being nothing. Then identify. But nothingness is not a thing. You understand, sir? Not a thing. Therefore, it is quite a different state of mind. Now, that is death, while there is living, breathing, sensations, the heart beating, the blood circulating, the brain active, undamaged. But our brains are damaged. DB. Can this damage be healed? Is it possible to heal the damage? K. Insight. That is what I want to get at. Our brains are damaged. For thousands of years, we have been hurt psychologically, inwardly. And that hurt is part of our brain cells, remembered hurts. The propaganda for 2,000 years that I am a Christian, that I believe in Jesus Christ, which is a hurt, or I am a Buddhist. You follow, sir? That is a hurt. So our brains are damaged. To heal that damage is to listen very carefully, to listen, and in the listening, to have an insight into what is being said. And therefore, there is immediately a change in the brain cells. Therefore, there is no identification, complete and total. Do you see the truth that identification is the root of the self with thought and all the rest of it? That is an absolute fact, like a cobra, like a dangerous animal, like a precipice, like taking deadly poison. So there is no identification absolutely when you see the danger. Then what is my relationship to the world, to nature, to my woman, man, child? When there is no identification, is there indifference, callousness, brutality? Do I say, I don't identify, and put my nose in the air? I am asking, sir, is this non-identification an ideal, a belief, an idea which I am going to live with, and therefore my relationship to the dog, to the wife, to the husband, to the girl, or whatever, it becomes very superficial, casual. It is only when identification is absolutely cut out of one's life that there is no callousness, because then relationship is real. I think it is very important to understand the relationship between you and the speaker, because if that relationship is not clearly understood, it will lead to a great deal of confusion. The speaker is not important at all. He is merely the voice, the telephone. But what is said when one is in the process of learning has an immense significance. If you give importance to the speaker as a teacher, you are merely creating a following, and thereby you are destroying yourself as well as what is being said. Both the follower and the teacher are a detriment to the process of learning. And when one is intent on learning, there is neither the teacher nor the follower. I think it is also important to understand that I am not talking to you as an individual who is opposed to society or as one who belongs to this or that group. To me, there is only the human being, whether he lives in India, in America, in Russia, in Germany, or anywhere else. I am not talking to you as an Indian with a particular system of beliefs, but together we are endeavoring to find out what this whole process of living is all about. This is our earth. It is not the Englishman's or the Russians, the Americans or the Indians. It is the earth on which we live, you and I. It does not belong to the communist or the capitalist, the Christian or the Hindu. It is our earth, to be lived on extensively, widely, and deeply. But that living is denied when you are a nationalist, when you belong to a party or an organized religion. Please believe me, these are the very things that are destroying human beings. Nationalism is a curse. To call oneself a Hindu or a Christian is also a curse because it divides us. We are human beings, not members of a sect or functionaries in a system. But the politician, the man who is committed to a conclusion or a system in which he has a vested interest, will exploit each one of us through our nationalism, through our vanity and emotionalism, just as the priest exploits us in the name of so-called religion. In considering these things together, I think it is very important for each one of us to understand that hearing is one thing, and listening, which brings action, is quite another. You may superficially agree when you hear it said that nationalism, with all its emotionalism and vested interest, leads to exploitation and the setting of man against man. But to really free your mind from the pettiness of nationalism is another matter. To be free not only from nationalism, but also from all the conclusions of organized religions and political systems, is essential if the mind is to be young, fresh, innocent, that is, in a state of revolution. And it is only such a mind that can create a new world, not the politicians who are dead, nor the priests who are caught in their own religious systems. Fortunately or unfortunately for yourself, you have heard something which is true, and if you merely hear it and are not actively disturbed so that your mind begins to free itself from all the things which are making it narrow and crooked, then the truth you have heard will become a poison. Surely, truth becomes a poison if it is heard and does not act in the mind, like the festering of a wound. But to discover for oneself what is true and what is false, and to see the truth in the false, is to let that truth operate and bring forth its own action. It is obviously of the greatest importance that as individual human beings, we understand for ourselves this whole process of living. Living is not just a matter of function and status. And if we are content to be mere functionaries with a certain status, we become mechanical, and then life passes us by. It seems to me that if one does not really participate in life, take to one's heart the fullness of life, then the mind becomes petty, narrow, full of the dogmatic beliefs which are now destroying human beings. I do not know if you have ever gone deeply within yourself. To do that, surely, you must put aside all explanations, all conclusions about yourself, all the knowledge you have acquired about the self. Only a free mind is capable of inquiring, not a mind that is tethered to some conclusion, belief, or dogma. If you have ever inquired very deeply into yourself, you are bound to have come upon that state which we call loneliness, a sense of complete isolation, of not being related. As a human being, you must at some time have felt that desperate, agonizing, despairing sense of isolation, from which, consciously or unconsciously, we are always running away. In our flight from the reality of that extraordinary sense of loneliness, we are driven, are we not, by a deep urge that is everlastingly seeking fulfillment through books, through music, through work and activity, through position, power, prestige. If at any time you have felt that sense of utter loneliness, or if you have ever consciously, deliberately allowed yourself to be aware of it, you will know that you immediately want to run away, to escape from it. You go to the temple, worship a god, plunge into perpetual activity, talk everlastingly, explain things away, or turn on the radio. We all do this, as we well know if we are at all conscious of ourselves. Now, to realize that escape in any form will never satisfy this deep urge for self-fulfillment, to see that it is insatiable, a bottomless pit, you must be aware of it totally, which means that you must see the truth that escapes have no reality. You may escape through God or through drink, but they are both the same. One is not more sacred than the other. You have to understand this hidden urge and go beyond it, and you cannot understand and go beyond it if you have not tasted that extraordinary loneliness, that darkness which has no way out, no hope. Hope comes into being when there is despair. A mind is in despair only because it is frustrated in its hope. To understand this deep urge, this hidden want, you must perceive it totally, as you might perceive a tree or a lovely flower. Then you can go beyond it, and once beyond it, you will find there is a complete aloneness which is entirely different from being lonely. But you cannot discover that state of complete aloneness without understanding the deep urge to fulfill yourself, to escape from loneliness. All this may sound unusual, unreal, and perhaps you will say, "What has this got to do with our daily living?" I think it is intimately related to your daily living, because your daily living is a misery of frustration. There is an everlasting striving to be, to become something, which is the real outcome of this deep urge, this hidden want. On the surface, you may practice discipline, control your mind, meditate, talk about peace or what you will, but it is all nonsense as long as you do not understand the hidden want that is driving you. That state of aloneness is essential because our minds are worn out with constant effort. What is your life? You are constantly trying to be this and not to be that, striving everlastingly to become famous, to get a better job, to be more efficient. You are making endless effort, are you not? I wonder if you have ever noticed what a miserable existence we have, always striving to be something, to be good, to be nonviolent, ceaselessly talking about peace while indulging in political emotionalism and preparing for war. Our life is one of strife, turmoil, travail, and a mind in that condition can never be fresh, young, new. Surely, seeing all this, one must have asked oneself whether such effort is necessary to live in this world. There may be a different way of living altogether, a way of living without effort, not at the lowest level, like a cow, nor like a human being who is forever doing what he likes, but at the highest level, a level where there is no effort. But you cannot say, "How am I to realize that state of mind in which there is no effort?" Because the very desire to acquire that state is another form of attachment. And all attachment is to things that are dying or dead. You are attached to the dead, not to the living. You are attached not to your wife, who is a living human being, but to the wife of pleasurable memory. You cannot be attached to the living, moving river. You are attached to the pleasure of having seen that river, which is a memory, a dead thing. There is a way of living which is completely effortless. Please, I am not asking you to accept this. It has nothing to do with acceptance or denial. You simply don't know it. All you know is effort, strife. You are perpetually driving yourself to be or not to be something. and your aggressive pursuit of your own ambitions, with its tensions and contradictions, is the outcome of this hidden want. You cannot remove this hidden want by mesmerizing yourself. You have to look at it, and you cannot look at it as long as you are escaping. You can look at it only when you come to it completely without fear, because it is the fact. Don't dictate what the fact should be. Let the fact tell you what it is. Most of us come to the fact with an opinion about the fact, with knowledge, with belief, which is an immature, a childish thing to do. You must come to the fact with innocence, with a fullness of heart, which is humility. Then the fact will tell you what it is. This hidden want is extraordinarily deep and subtle, but if you are able to look at it without any opinion, without any fear, then you will discover that you can go beyond its darkness to a state in which the mind is totally alone and therefore no longer the result of influence. This aloneness is the state of attention. In this aloneness, which is the state of attention, there is no shadow of concentration. Being alone, uninfluenced, not caught in opinion, the mind is completely attentive. It is motionless, silent, utterly still. But you cannot make the mind still. You can mesmerize the mind by repeating certain phrases, or quiet it by prayer, but that is not stillness. That is death. It is like putting the mind in a straitjacket to hold it still, and therefore the mind decays. What is essential is to understand this deep, hidden want, which is always changing, and that is the beauty of it. You think you have understood it, only to find that it has moved somewhere else. So one has to pursue this hidden want down all the dark corridors of the mind. Then there comes that aloneness which is attention and which is really a motionless state. I am not using that word motionless in opposition to activity. A mind that is motionless still is not a dead mind. It is an active mind. It is activity itself, because it is still, and only such a mind is creative.